Interview with Billy Hunter, 17 February 1992.
Yeah, I did a little research last night in the baseball encyclopedia, and it looked like you played 6 years.
6 years in the major league.
Yeah, you started off, I believe, with, I think I noticed that you started off with Brooklyn and got traded before you made it to the majors?
That's right. I spent 5 years in their minor league system, and after my fifth year in their system, the fourth and fifth year, I was at Fort Worth, Texas, in the Texas League, and the fifth year, I was the most valuable player in that league, and the Dodgers sold me to the St. Louis Browns while I was playing winter baseball in Puerto Rico. And the Browns became the Orioles the following year. And then I was the first shortstop with the Orioles. And then at the close of that season, Paul Richards took over the whole Oriole. He was the general manager and the manager, and he made a trade with the New York Yankees that involved 17 players.
Well, that's a big trade.
And in my speaking engagements, I usually allude to it as the Hunter Larson Turley trade. I said most of you might have heard about it differently than that, but it allowed me to, I spent 2 years with the Yankees and then was traded to Kansas City and then to Cleveland. And my last year as a player, I played for San Diego, which was a AAA club for Cleveland out in the Coast League. And then I retired after that season. I was 31 at the time and was had as good a year as I could have, and led the club in almost all categories, was on the All-Star team out in the Coast League, and they sold my contract to Toronto, which was also a AAA club at that time. And I said, if I can't get back to the big leagues at age 31 with the kind of year I had, there's no sense going to Toronto to play another year and hope to get back at age 32. So I retired from the game as a player. I had an insurance agency here in town, Paul, and was out of the game entirely in 1960. In 1961, Hoot Evers was the acting general manager of Cleveland, and he asked me to do some scouting, professional scouting, scouting the International League. He just wanted to report on all the International League players. And while I did that, Mae McPhail, who was the general manager of the Orioles at the time, said, Bill, I would appreciate it if you'd give me a report on the Rochester Club, which was the Oriole AAA club at the time. And that year, the three best players in the International League were Boog Powell, Tommy Tresh, and Don Clendenin. And of course, they all three went and had good years in the next year. And Cleveland offered me the same type of an arrangement for the following year, but McPhail asked me if I would not work for the Orioles on a year-round basis. And just speaking to service clubs and selling tickets and minor league infield instructor and managing the Bluefield Club, the rookie league club in the Appalachian League. And then at the close of that season, scouting the National League for interleague trades and so forth. So I told Lee that I would take that job with the understanding that when there was a coaching job available on the parent club, that I'd be considered for that. My first year in Bluefield, I had an 18-year-old kid by the name of Mark Belanger with my shortstop. And of course, I think he made 3 errors in the entire season, and all of them were throwing. He never missed a ball. And the funny thing, how things work out, his two boys played here at Towson State. One a couple years ago was our leading hitter and was a prospect, but he had arthroscopic surgery on his shoulder and didn't even play his senior year. So it went the full cycle. I had the dad as an 18-year-old, and the two kids were even older than that here. So it turned out that I managed Bluefield 2 years, and then when Bauer was named the manager in 1964, I became the third base coach. And I worked as the third base coach through the mid-77. Weaver took over in 68 or 67, I think, as the manager. And then I went to Texas as the manager in June of 77, through the 78 season. And I've been here since 1979, so you know my history now.
When you went to Texas,
yes.
Evidently they had a lot of turmoil that year. That was the year, I guess, that Sonny Randall hit Frank Lucchese in spring training. And then that was also the year that Eddie Stanky managed for about one game, yeah. And then you went, I guess they had a coach, I guess, as an interim manager.
Connie Wright.
And then you were hired. So I guess that was pretty a tumultuous season in Texas.
It was. I was called early on in the, well, not early on, but about a month before I ended up being the manager, as to my interest. And we had, the Orioles had played Texas a half dozen times in spring training. We trained, the Orioles trained in Miami, and Texas was in Pompano, and was very close, and they had some talent. And when they asked of my interest, I said, yes, I would be interested. It was the fourth or fifth opportunity that I had to manage in the big leagues, and I figured it was time that I take one of them, and I felt that they had the talent that could be successful. The one thing we needed more than anything was a relief pitcher or two. We had a lot of good starting pitchers, but some of them were five-inning pitchers, and I had Doyle Alexander, and I had Gaylord Perry, and I had Ferguson Jenkins, and I had Kurt Rylev, and I had John Matlack, and Doc Medich, and Doc Ellis, and starting pitching-wise, I probably had better talent than anybody in baseball. It was just that several of them, five innings was about all they could do, six maybe, and Doyle Alexander was an enigma. He was the type of guy that could have a no-hitter or a one-hitter for five innings, and then all of a sudden he had nothing, and there was no warning or anything. And the first year I was there, I had I picked up Reggie Cleveland from Don Zimmer was managing the Red Sox at the time, and Don and I had been roommates in the Dodger organization in Vero Beach for a couple of years. So he was trying to get rid of Reggie Cleveland and knew I needed a relief pitcher real bad, and so we were able to pick him up. And I had Roger Morette, who was great. But Roger got involved with drugs, and he were in batting practice one day, and I came in the clubhouse to find him in a catatonic state, standing with one foot up and just staring straight ahead, and we put him in a hospital for a while. He did come back, but he wasn't the same. It was a difficult time in that it was the time when drugs were just becoming prevalent in professional athletics, and I had no training along those lines. It was difficult to know who was and who wasn't, but their behavior was really unusual. I had an opportunity in the mid-season of 1978. Brad Corbett, the owner of the club, called me in and offered me my choice. He said, "I'll have on your desk two contracts tomorrow. You sign either one you want. One was for 3 years and one was for 5 years." I told Brad that I didn't want either one of them. And I said, "I will take a 1 year, only because I know how much you want to win it, and I would like to be the guy that does that." But it was just at the start of the time when long-term contracts were coming into use, and when I went there as the manager, I had eight players with five or more year guaranteed contracts, no trade, no cut. And I said, "Brad, how do you motivate people like that? What can you do as the manager to get the most out of those type of athletes?" And he said, "Well, I'll give you a 10-year contract." And I said, "That's not going to change the situation. That'll just mean I have to put up with it for 10 years. So I really got disenchanted with the way things were at that time, and I think it was just being perhaps in the wrong place at the wrong time. Most people felt that I came here just biding my time till another job became available, and in fact, for two or three years, had several calls. I had no intention of going back. I had 31 years in the game as a player and coach and manager, and enjoyed it tremendously. And I hope that I put as much into the game as I got out of it. I am no qualms about what I'm doing right now, nor any desire to be back into professional baseball.
So you left
at the close of the season in 78. We agreed after he had offered me a 3 or 5, we agreed orally on a 1 year deal. And the more he got to thinking about it, this was in mid-season in 78. I figured, well, if I'm going to change, get a new manager after that, I might as well get a new one for next year. And so the last game of the season, well, after the last game of the season in Seattle in 78, Corbett flew in to Seattle from Fort Worth, and Eddie Robinson took me out after the game and said, "Bill, we're going to have a new manager for next year." And Brad Corbett took Fat Corrales out and said, "Fat, you're going to be my manager next year." And so I did not manage the last game of the 78 season.
So I guess was it the combination of the money and the long-term contracts and the messing around with drugs then
certainly a combination of that. My wife had no desire to live in Texas. She was here. In fact, when I had the contracts on the desk, my desk in the stadium in Arlington, Texas. I picked up the phone and called Marilyn and said, which one of these you want me to sign? She said, neither one of them. And, so that had a lot to do with the decision also. And but it was just a case of not being able to do the things that, Casey Stengel or when I was playing and so forth. I think that during my days as a player, drugs weren't even a part of, alcohol was, and of course there were some days when some people showed up at the ballpark that perhaps they shouldn't have been in uniform, but it was a whole new experience, and early on nobody knew how to go about working around that situation, and I'm sure that it's a terrible thing, but I don't see it being as prevalent now as it was back in the late 70s or early 80s.
Well, when you left Texas and you came back, I guess you came back to Baltimore.
I did.
Did you look for a job in colleges, or were you going to go back to your insurance business?
No, I came. I got the job as baseball coach here within a week or two after I returned to town. I had talked to the president of the university. He's not the president now. Before I'd ever gone to spring training, and told him that that I, in the near future, that I felt like I would be wanting to get into the collegiate scene, and he said, "You've got a job here whenever you want to come." So I called him when I got back, and for $5,000, I became the baseball coach at Towson.
Quite a difference in salary, I imagine.
Yeah.
How is it different, or was it different, for coaching a college team as opposed to managing a professional team?
Oh, the talent very much different in that I couldn't believe that two kids couldn't play catch with one another without somebody chasing the ball half the time. I'm talking about just the fact in the this time of year we start practice and we're indoors, I instituted after the first year, I instituted a rule: anytime the ball hit the gym floor, the thrower and the catcher just took a trip around it. And I had a couple of people that never warmed up. They'd make one throw and then make a turn and make another throw, and I was amazed. Our present baseball coach was a senior player at the time, and I was amazed in taking infield practice that somebody catch the ball and couldn't find the first baseman before we put the fence around our field. Our first baseman or the extra first baseman was always chasing the ball up the bank when we were taking infield practice. It's just, the kids, I think the kids understand the game. I just think that at our level, the ability, now we do have a young man in the big leagues right now that pitched for me, Chris Nebholz, left-hander with Montreal. And we knew when he got here that he was going to be a professional baseball player. They're not hard to... I don't know if you happened to see 60 Minutes last night, the young left-hander, the black kid that signed, the Yankees signed, from North Carolina. Just watching him throw, it's quite evident. He throws in the mid-90s with his fastball, and I don't know how we ever judged talent before we had those radar guns to tell that somebody's throwing 89 or 92. I think that you can pretty much tell when somebody can throw hard or can't throw hard.
When you were playing, you know, the money wasn't as much. I guess you had to have jobs in the off season to make ends meet.
Oh, most definitely. Our sports information director is a real fan, our associate director is a real baseball fan, and he said something to me the other day about Malacky getting, you know, winning his arbitration case, and I said, well, shouldn't he have? I said, he said, well, there was $1,000,001 or something like that, and I said, yeah, and he'll pitch more innings than anybody on the staff. And I said, he'll probably be underpaid compared to the salaries that are out there today. But my high salary as a player in the big leagues was $15,000. And that was and I didn't even get that in the big, that's what they paid me in San Diego. You know, that was in AAA when I was, after spending 6 years in the big leagues. The minimum salary when I signed with the Browns was $5,000, and so it's kind of tough. But I saw when I went to Texas as the manager and saw some of the salaries those fellas were making with guaranteed contracts and so forth. So that was just the start of it. It's kind of tough to comprehend
right.
In today's field.
Do you think that there's a ceiling somewhere that it's going to hit?
I got somebody sent me from the Cleveland Plain Dealer last summer a bunch of articles that were in the paper. Now, this was in the 1940s. And they were talking about baseball could never last the way they were spending money and so forth and so on. And of course, I was involved. I was with the Orioles when they had the first player strike. And we turned off a lot of people with stores. It seems like the sport overcomes all the adversities, no matter what they are. But my concern is when and if the television money dries up. Now it's kind of tough to turn on the television these days without seeing somebody playing baseball or basketball or football, or right now it's the Olympics, of course. But when is it going to and I guess as long as the people are willing to pay what it costs to go to the games, and for a family to take, for mom and dad to take a couple of kids to a ball game nowadays, it takes a pretty good hunk out of the paycheck to make a visit to the and then especially if you're going to buy a hot dog or two or a soft drink. But it seems to be as popular as ever, and I know that when I played with the Orioles and coached with the Orioles, well, more coached than played, because when I coached, we had, during that period of time, we had the best team in baseball. And we were drawing 1,000,002, and so forth, and everybody said, you know, that's all we're going to draw. Well, now if they draw under two, they're really put out. You know, there's something wrong, almost every home game, there's a promotion of some. They're giving something away, and.
In fact, the paper said, I think it was yesterday's paper, said that with the new stadium, they're expecting $3 million.
Oh, yeah. And there's no doubt in my mind they'll get it. The stadium is going to be beautiful. Everybody asked me, I said, well, see, I don't get into the what's in the stands so much. All I know is the playing field at Memorial Stadium was the best in the business, and that's what you look for when you're in uniform. You don't want, now the first year we played here, it wasn't the best in the business. You know, it was kind of a rock pile. But Pat Santarone did a great job with the field itself, and his successor has done the same thing, and the players enjoyed playing in Baltimore because they knew they were going to get a true hop, and everything was good. Texas was a little difficult because it's so dang hot there. They used to have to put the field underwater in the morning, and by game time, it was still like concrete, you know, so it... They work hard at making those fields playable.
When you were with the Yankees in the, I guess it was the mid 50s, 55, 56.
Right.
How did that team compare with the Orioles you coached for, the 69, 70, 71?
I think very comparable in that, you know, Mantle and Barra were doing their thing, and with young players like Scourin and Elston Howard, and we had McDougal and Carey and Bauer, and a combination of left fielders, and Joe Collins, Jerry Coleman, and pitching with Ford and Turley and Larson and Johnny Cox and Sturgevant and Virgil Trucks and some of those. But comparing, you know, when you take a Frank and a Brooks and a Boog and a Paul Blair in center field and 420 game winners in one season, and it was kind of fun to go to the park. And it was fun being a third base coach because you knew that if you did make a mistake as far as sending somebody in and being out or holding somebody up and we didn't score, somebody was going to come up and make amends for that. And it was just a delightful time to be a member of the Baltimore Orioles.
How was it working for Earl Weaver?
Earl was a feisty little guy and very knowledgeable about the game, as most little guys are. You know, they're mouthy, I guess is the word, but he and Palmer used to go at it all the time. And yet, he knew the game, he worked with the game, he utilized his players probably as well as anybody in the game. He utilized the whole team. I recall we probably had as close a knit coaching staff as anybody in the game, and that Bamberger and Fry and Stoller and Weaver and I were spend a lot of time together, and it was talking about the team. And I recall one lunch we were having in Milwaukee. Kenny Singleton had got off to a real bad start, and he was hitting like 160 something and playing every day. And the suggestion from one of the coaches was, really, we ought to put somebody in there instead of Singleton. And Weir says, no, Singleton's going to hit 300. And in order for him to do that, he's going to have to hit 450 from now till the end of the season. And if he's sitting on the bench, that won't do us any good. And sure enough, he did just what Earl said. Many times you get kind of put out with somebody because of their performance, and so you sit them and see if somebody else can play, but you never know when they're not going to hit that 300 that they hit every year and so forth, and as it turned out, he did hit his 300, I recall when I went to Texas, the Orioles were in town in Texas, and I said to Wheeler, I said, I'm thinking about making Hargrove the leadoff hitter. And he says, well, I can understand that. But he can't run a lick, you know. You're really clogging up the bases. I said, he gets 100 walks every year, and he hits 300 every year, so he's going to be on base 50% of the time. And I said, I have Campanaris, who I can bunt every time he gets on base, because he's the best bunter in baseball, and then I have people like Al Oliver and Richie Zisk and Bobby Bonds and Warren Benefus, and I did do that. But Campanaris got peeved with me because I had him bunting all the time. And I said, he was one of the fellows that had a 5-year contract, no trade, no cut. And I said, Bert, what do you care what you hit? I said, it's not going to make any difference in your contract. He said, but I can hit. And I said, yeah, but you're the best bunter in baseball. I said, I don't care what Bert Campanaris does. I care what the Texas Rangers do. And you can help the club. But he had 44 sacrifice hits the 1 year for me. And the Chicago White Sox team, the entire team, had 36. And about every 10 days, he's in my office, coach, let me swing the bat. And one game, I took him, he wasn't playing. And Tommy Grieve, who is now the general manager, was at bat in the last of the ninth inning with the bases loaded, one man out. And I called him back and I put Campanaris up to hit. And I said, Bert, don't swing the bat. Said, I'm going to squeeze with you, but I don't want you swinging the bat. I'll let you know when. So the first pitch comes and he swings and misses, but he did it intentionally, you know. Now, I'd have rather he had taken the ball because I didn't know when to squeeze because they knew what I was doing in putting him up there, and now I'm figuring, well, hell, it's one strike. Now they're going to pitch out, but I put it on anyway, and here comes the pitch, and he lays down, beautiful bunt, and the winning run touches the plate, and it's all over. And Campanaris is peeved because I had him, and Tommy Grieve is peeved because I took him out, and I said, Tommy, if you hit a ground ball, he couldn't run either, he was like cargo. I said, it's a made-to-order double play. I said, this way, the only thing I have to be concerned about is a pitch-out. Because I know if Campanaris can reach the ball, he'll lay it down and the ball game's over. And I said, that's what we're here for, is to win games. Well, anyway, it turned out all right, but it was like I had done a disservice by asking him to squeeze in that situation, and I said, well, It's another victory for the Texas Rangers. Let's go tomorrow.
How much of your time as a manager is spent explaining what it is you're doing to players so that I get to...
My office, just like here, my office door is always open and we communicate a lot. I don't think you have the opportunity to explain beforehand or while it's going on. It's just the results that they can, I think, now I don't know, but I think we won more games while I managed in Texas than they've ever won. And we had a good ball club. As I said, if we'd had a couple of Greg Olson or somebody like that, we'd have won the pennant both years I was there. Now the first year when I took over, there were two games under 500 when I took over the club. And we went 60-33 for the remainder of the season. In fact, Weaver beat me out as manager of the year that year. But Kansas City won 20 out of their last 22 ball games to beat us by 5 games. And probably 4 or 5 of those 20 were against us. So, that was the difference. And Herzog had a pretty good club in those days, too. But it was fundamentally, they were really inept. And we worked a lot on the fundamental things. And I think that's Earl and I go back a long time. We played against one another in the minor leagues, in the old Texas League, and then when I became the minor league infield instructor for the Orioles while we were in camp together at Thomasville, Georgia, when he was managing Elmira and Rochester and so forth. So he grew up in the Cardinal organization, and I grew up in the Dodger organization, and it was Ricky both times. So fundamentally, we came out of the same mold as far as how to play the game is concerned. Earl didn't like to bunt at all. He didn't like to give up an out. And that's fine if you have the talent to not do that. The Yankees didn't bunt much either. The Yankees didn't steal many bases either. They just waited for their big guys to come up to bat. And Earl's favorite, when he first took over, he said, whatever happened to the bases loaded double? And then it was whatever, then his new cry became, whatever happened to the 3-run home run? But that's what he played for, the big end. And of course, when you have a great defensive team, which the Orioles always had, we always had more gold glovers than anybody else, and good pitching. And I used to argue with Bamberger all the time about his, you know, he says 4 20 game winners in 1 year. And I said, yeah, but what comes, what's the chicken or the egg? All those guys, I said, here's Pat Dobson that came over from San Diego where he was 12-18, and now all of a sudden he's 20-8. And I said, Pat, what are you doing different from what you did last year? He says, well, I'm not doing anything different. He said, the difference is when a ball was hit in San Diego, it was either a base hit or an error. When the ball's hit in Baltimore, it's one out or two outs, depending on whether there's a man on base or not. And he said, that's the difference. And that's what I used to, with Bamberger was the pitching coach, you know. And I said, well, what about Brooks Robinson or Aparicio or Belanger or Davey Johnson or Bobby Grinch or were Paul Blair in the center field. I said, you know, those guys all have gold gloves on their, and I said, don't you think they have something to do with those wins and losses? It's kind of like Satchel Paige when my first year in the big league, Satchel was a pitcher for the St. Louis Browns. And he's pitching against the Red Sox in Sportsman's Park in St. Louis. And there's two men out in the ninth inning, and we're up by one run. There's two men on base, and he's got two strikes on Tommy Umflett, who was a rookie in 1953, just like I was. And Satchel didn't ever know anybody's name. Marty comes running out of the dugout, and he says, I want you to throw up about the bill of his cap. Satchel says, Skip, that's about the only pitch this guy can hit. He says, no, you'll strike him out, the game will be over, and we'll be in the clubhouse. So here, Marty goes back, and he's not even in the dugout. Here's the pitch, it's right there. And Umflett hit it off the left center field fence in St. Louis. Two run score, and he's on third base. We're down by one run. And of course, we didn't score in the bottom of the ninth, so we lose 4-3 or whatever it was. Anyway, we go in the clubhouse after the game, and Marty gets the table in the clubhouse. And I just want everybody to know I take the responsibility for that loss. And Satchel says, do you want the L also, Skip? Losing pitcher? You want to be the losing pitcher? So those are the kind of things that go on all the time.
Well, what was it like when you got traded from a non-contender to the Yankees?
Well, what it was like was I went up to the Yankees and sat down with George Weiss about my contract for the coming year, and George Weiss told me that he wasn't giving me any raise because I was going to get a World Series share. And I said, what's that have to do with the season? And after winning it the first year, I went back to the same thing, and he says, well, you're going to get another World Series share. And it was nice, you know, it was nice getting a World, in fact, that check for, we lost to the Dodgers in 55, and I had a broken leg during that series. Casey, I had played 98 games on August 6th, and Casey took me in. We were playing against Cleveland in Yankee Stadium. Casey took me out for a pinch hitter in the sixth inning. Herb Score was pitching for Cleveland. And he said, Bill, I'm sending you to Denver. And I said, no, you're not. And we just made a Western trip where I was 14 for 28 on the trip. And I was, you know, I was playing as good as I ever played. And, you know, a lot of times pitchers concentrate on the Mantles and the Bearers and those kind of people, and you come to bat, they just lay it in there. And I was feeling good about it. Now he's going to send me to Denver. And I said, Casey, I'm not going. And he said, well, there's only two guys on the club that have options, you and Elton Howard. He said, I can't send Elton Howard out. He's my only black player. They'd crucify me. And Elton really wasn't playing very much. And I had played almost every game at shortstop. Phil was at the end of his career. And anyway, I got on the train New York and came to Baltimore. And I'm here for about 4 or 5 days, and Ralph Hart called me. He was managing out in Denver. He said, "Bill, I need you bad." He says, "I know how upset you are." Casey says, "Now don't worry about the World Series. Whatever happens there, you can't play in it, but you'll share in anything that..." I said, "That doesn't have anything to do with it." I said, "Hell, I'm as much a part of this team as anybody else." And he says, "Well, you'll be back. You're going to be my shortstop next year, but we have a chance to get Enos Slaughter from the Cardinals and make him eligible for the World Series." And they did, and I ended up going to Denver, I broke my leg after about 8 or 10 games out there, and was at the World Series with a cast on. And then in 56, that was the year they went to Japan after the World Series, and Dr. Bennett here in town was treating me, and Casey said, "You can go with the team if you have a cast off." Well, it was to come off for a week before they were leaving. And Dr. Bennett, I went down to see him, he said, "I'm going to leave it on for another 2 weeks." And I said, "Well, I can't go to Japan if you're going to do that." And he said, "That's why I'm going to leave it on." He said, "I don't want you over there with no.
Work out of turn number four as Kyle tries to hold onto the spot. Hut Strickland works on him.
But I went down to see him. He said, "I'm going to leave it on for another 2 weeks." And I said, "Well, I can't go to Japan if you're going to do that." And he said, "That's why I'm going to leave it on." He said, "I don't want you over there with no medical attention that we're aware of." And he said, "This is for your own good." So I didn't make the trip with it. And I went spring training early, and everything was going fine. I seemed to be fine. Then all of a sudden, I could hardly walk one morning. I got out of bed, and I guess it was the adhesions and everything had... So I opened the season in 56 on the disabled list. And then just before trading deadline, we had a foot race. Irv Norm had cartilage operations on both knees, and they were going to put one of us back on the list, but the way they decided, we both started the left field foul pole and ran as far as the visitor's dugout in Yankee Stadium. in a foot race. Whoever won the race was coming off the disabled knee. Well, I beat Norton by 50 feet, you know. So I come off the disabled list, and Eddie Robinson, who was my roommate, was traded to Kansas City in order to make room for me. But then it came, well, we were riding to Boston on a sleeper, and we're in the dining car. Casey said, now I want you to put, I think I was hitting 380, and I'd only played in, you know, I don't know, 40 games, 50 games or something like that. Casey said, I want you to pick the pitchers that you want to play against. He says, you're going to hit 300 this year. And I said, Casey, I can't. I got to play every day. And he says, no, I want you. Oh, but anyway, I convinced him I had to play every day. And I end up hitting 280. I dropped 100 points between the time that the... But come World Series time, I didn't get in one game. We played in 7 games. And every time Stengel would move on the bench, I'd go move and sit down beside him. Casey, you do know I'm here. But that was the... that thing up there, that Larson pitched the perfect game in the World Series that year, and he sent that to all the teammates. That was his Christmas card to all the teammates that year. But I sat on the bench the whole time it was going on.
So you never got to play in a World Series either year?
No. Broken leg the first year, and that was, as a player, that was the only two times I was involved in a few as the third base coach, but never got in. That's my biggest disappointment.
Well, I can imagine it would be to sit on the bench, you know,
right,
for the whole 7 games.
That when that game was going on, the 7th inning, I used to throw out Collins with the infield ball. He'd throw it into the dugout, and I'd take it, and I'd put it in a certain spot. And I'd sit down. Anyway, Matt will come in, and he sat down where I'd been sitting. And I said, hey, where have you been sitting? He said, I've been sitting there on the steps. I said, well, get up there. I said, we can't be changing anything now. It was getting, and that's the most excited I think I've ever seen Stengel at a ball game. The last couple of innings, he was up on the top step, you know, going through all his antics and so forth. And the last pitch that Larson, you know, everybody went bananas. That's probably, there's a good chance that that might be the only one. It's the only one there's ever been, and I don't know whether anybody will break DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak, nor break Larson's perfect game, or tie it. Can't break it. I've had some good experiences. All I can do is talk about it.
Occasionally, I guess, you see articles in the paper or something where they talk about, you know, baseball players then as opposed to baseball players now, and the level of play going down or being better, or depending upon who you're reading. How do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, I think talent-wise, I think the kids now have as much or more talent. I think that they work at it more. It's a year-round type of thing now. You know, when I played, you got in shape in spring training. You didn't do all of that training in the off season to go to spring training, and that's what spring training was for, to go and get ready for the season. And you know, all you have to do is look at the Olympics, and people do things, they jump higher, they run faster, I just think that I don't know why there aren't, you know, they're adding a couple of new teams to the big leagues now, and probably the big thing is that when I played, when I signed with the Dodgers, they had 21 farm clubs. You know, there were three AAA clubs and two AA clubs, and I don't know how many A clubs, and it was D, C, B, A in those days, but hell, there was 470-some players in Vero Beach that all belonged to the Brooklyn Dodgers. Not, you know, there were 600-some in the big leagues now, but there was one organization and Ricky's theory was to sign anybody that could run and throw and let them play, and if they did the other things, why, they would eventually get to the big leagues. But there were a lot of guys that didn't reach the big leagues in those days because of so many players and so few major league clubs. And of course now there's more major league clubs, and the big difference as I see it is that, and perhaps it's because of my training in the Dodger organization, fundamentally they probably did things better than any other organization in those days. Now I'm sure other clubs are doing that now, but the big thing as I see it now is that many of the kids are learning how to play in the major leagues. It isn't their talent, their God-given talent, that they're lacking in. It's just their knowledge of how to do it, and that's the big difference I see. I saw it in professional football when they expanded, it was a rock and sock, and you could see the difference but more than anything else, I think the athletes today have more God-given talent than most of the athletes did back in those days. I just feel that today they're trying to propel them too fast. A kid like the McDonald kid with the Orioles, he's got all kinds of talent, but he should have been putting that talent together in the minor leagues so that when he got to the big leagues, he was solid. And I don't know, Messina might turn out to be the same way. Now, both those kids have outstanding arms, and some of them, I can remember David Clyde when, the Rangers signed him. Now that's before I was there, but they pitched him in the big leagues a couple of times before they sent him out, and Krause with Kansas City, the same thing. They pitched him a couple of times before they sent him out just to get their bonus money out of him before they... So I think it's just the way they handle them more than anything else. The talent's there, and I don't know why, with all of the little league programs and the amateur teams and the high school teams and the college teams and so forth, there ought to be a hell of a lot more potential professional big league players in the wings than there are. Everybody, I hear the scouts when we play a game, depending on who we're playing, there might be anywhere from a half dozen to 20 watching this play. And all I hear from them is there's no talent around. There's no, you know, and I guess what they're looking for is somebody that can go from this level to the big league level now. Maybe that's the way the game has changed.
Do you think, being an athletic director, do you think that the minor leagues are going to go away and the major leagues are going to be dependent upon colleges, or do you think it'll still stay kind of the way it is now?
I don't think they can do that with baseball. I don't think there's... We're kind of stymied in the Northeast here in that, you know, we start our season, when we play our early games, it's terrible. The conditions are terrible. And of course, they are in the big leagues as well, but we start our games in March here when they're playing in Florida. Now, of course, you get the people down in the South and the Southwest and so forth. By the time we get our first game in the scorebook, they have 20 or so already played. And I think they have to have the minor leagues in order to make it work.
I saw something that they're changing. They're thinking about changing college baseball to where the season starts later and ends later.
Yeah, but I have a proposal, and we discussed it. It's good as far as professional baseball would be concerned. It'd be great, but as far as you know, our school's over the second week of May. Well. Our kids are not going to go to summer school in order to play baseball. Nor is our institution going to allow us to spend the money on housing and meals and so forth in order to. We can't pay our expenses now. In the type of weather that, and that would, the thing that would make baseball work in this area, and even in Michigan and so forth, would be fall baseball. The weather is much better in the fall. You get to play, you don't. But then you're competing against football, and I'm talking about on your campuses and so forth. But I know that we get our fall program is kind of like our spring training. That's when we determine who's going to be on the team for the spring. When the spring starts and so forth, there's nobody. Other than maybe an occasional footballer or two that might want to be on the baseball team as well, there's nobody, there's no surprises come spring. The fall program is spring training. Yes. Yes.
This concluded the interview with Billy Hunter.